4 minutes after one here on cliffcentral.com with me, Mabale Moloi, and it's the News Talk Hour. We do a wrap-up of all the important news stories from the last week or so. You know, the things that have caught your attention, maybe even made you laugh, maybe even got you a little bit upset and angry. That tends to happen a lot in the world of politics. Joining me this afternoon from the Daily Maverick is Sisonke Msimango. Good afternoon, Sisonke. How are you?
I'm good.
You and I are both infested with the flu virus.
We are.
It's such a bad time of the year. Everyone around me is sick.
Yes, and so if we're particularly mean to the politicians today, it's because we're in a bad mood because we're sick.
I like that justification. It works for me. Okay, so Sisonke, let's start with, on a comical note, because a lot of people are talking about the events that went down in Parliament yesterday. The political parties got an opportunity to debate and give their thoughts and feedback to the President's State of the Nation address. In fact, if you log on to the dailymaverick.co.za, you will come across Sisonke's article, her take on what she thought of President Jacob Zuma's State of the Nation address. But to begin on that comical note, here are a few classical moments from our very favorite politician, Julius Malema. No, that would not be it. Let's try this again.
Honorable Chairperson, the Speaker called the Deputy President of the Republic, Cyril Ramaphosa, and I think he's honorable as the member of this House. Can you rule on that? Thank you.
Honorable Malema, the Honorable Deputy President of this House is an honorable member of this House.
No problem, Honorable Cyril Ramaphosa.
Please debate the state of the nation. The factional battles and whatever, let them stay.
No, Chair, I don't agree with that. No, I don't agree with that.
Honorable Malema.
You are not going to tell me, Chair, how I must debate.
Order, Chair.
Point of order, Chair. You are not going to tell me how I must debate.
On point of order, Chair.
No, I can't be told what to say.
Honorable Malema. Order, members.
Egophone Frau, why does he deliver his speech in a white man's language of English, not in his own mother tongue?
Honorable Malema, are you prepared to respond to the question?
I have no time for racist questions.
Honorable Malema, withdraw those remarks.
Honorable Chair.
On the factional tendencies or otherwise of the Honorable Bladen Zimande.
Okay, Honorable Chair, withdraw.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Economic transformation means...
Honorable Malema, I'm afraid your time is up. Thank you very much.
No, but those orders you are eating on my time...
Honorable Malema!
Chair.
I mean, even the members in Parliament themselves were cracking up. They were clapping, clapping. It sounded like they were having a good time, Sisonke.
It definitely looked and sounded like a lot of fun.
joining us on the line as part of the conversation is Ranjini Munsami, who is also, of course, from the Daily Maverick. Ranjini, good afternoon. Can you hear me? Ranjini, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Now, Ranjini, you were actually, I understand that you were in Parliament yesterday when all of this unfolded. The political parties got an opportunity to debate the President's State of the Nation address. It sounded like it was quite a show with the antics that Julius Malema got up to. I had a look at your article on the Daily Maverick, and it's titled, Disorder in the House, the Musi and Juju Show Has Arrived. Now, Ranjini, let's begin with the EFF and Julius Malema and just take us through the first-hand experience of what Julius Malema got up to in Parliament yesterday.
Okay, Mabale. You know, I've been covering Parliament for a while now, and I must tell you that, you know, it's a rare occasion for the House to be as lively as it was. and, you know, there was one day I was with my colleagues, Rebecca and Greg Nicholson in the gallery, and I mean, we've never laughed as much as we, you know, as we did yesterday. It was highly entertaining. You know, it was very much anticipated of how the EFF will fit into this new role as a political party in Parliament. We used to Julius Malema being given a mic, you know, taking to a podium. shouting from there and shouting obscenities and, revving up a crowd. Parliamentary politics are quite a different matter altogether. It's a very staid affair. There's very definite speaking times. There's rules that govern how parliamentary debates should be conducted. There's a certain level of decorum in terms of how people address each other. So, you know, it was something fascinating to behold how the EFF adapted to that new role. And I tell you what, Mabale, that Julius was battling a bit with that because, you know, he's used to shouting at people. And there was one stage where he came pretty close to being frog-marched out of parliament while he was speaking because he didn't want to address people like Blade and Zimande as honorable, and he also didn't want to. He made a few insults against the ANC government for which he was called to order. Mm-hmm. For example, he accused the ANC of murdering the miners at Marikana. Now, obviously, it's a game of semantics because those miners are in fact dead and they were shot dead by the police who are part of the government. So, you know, he was stating a point very clearly, but parliamentary rules dictate that you can't, defame people and you can't make allegations that are unsubstantiated against people. So Julius was battling with that. He was saying, no, I won't be told what to say. And when the person who was chairing that debate, Thandi Modise, tried to call him to order, and he was arguing with her, saying, no, I won't be told what I can and cannot say. So eventually he realized that he was sailing pretty close to the wind and could be frog marched out. So then he retreated and was allowed to continue with his speech.
Now, Ranjini, what about the argument that some people are posing, which is that Julius Malema is bordering on being disrespectful? From where I'm sitting, he is entertaining a lot of us because most people burst out laughing when they hear that clip or when they hear about what Julius Malema got up to in Parliament. Is he in fact being disrespectful? This is exactly what the EFF set out to do, to be disruptive towards the ruling party. Is this disrespectful?
I don't know yet, Mabale. It's the first day. Obviously, they put out their heavy hitters, Andile Mngutama and Julius Malema. And obviously, it was going to cause a ruckus. I don't know. As I say, you know, they're sailing pretty close to the wind, but they're doing what they set out to do. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to change the nature of opposition politics in South Africa. They wanted to show the ANC that it simply cannot continue to be uncontested in the way they govern South Africa. And they feel that perhaps, you know, the existing political parties are way too polite, and that is why the ANC is able to get away with what it had been getting away with in the past. But I don't know, if they can continue at this pace and at this level with that amount of rhetoric, and whether it would serve any purpose. That's the other thing that needs to be considered. Because if you just continue flinging insults and all that the ANC does is retreat and close ranks and do what Lindiwe Sisulu did yesterday and just fire back, then all it does is bring South African politics into an even greater mess than it is now. And it leaves the constituency behind because it doesn't really serve the interests of the people who elected these parties. I think that is why, Mabale, is that you see that the DA is taking a slightly different tack from what they had in the previous administration, where you found that Lindiwe Mazibuko was quite forthright and she was a heavy hitter for the DA. But there's a slightly different approach now from Musi Maimane, the new parliamentary leader, where he's being a bit more gentlemanly. He even went to the extent of wishing President Jacob Zuma well after his ill health and saying he's happy to see him. But he did what he was there to do as well, which is to tear the speech apart. But he was a bit nicer. And I think that is the DA's new approach. They realize that the Red Army is next to them. The Red Army is going to steal all the space of being the rabble rousers, and that they need to present themselves as the voices of reason now. So I think it's going to be a pretty interesting dynamic in Parliament, where you have all these different parties playing different roles with different approaches. And look, the ANC has a lot of experience in politics. I don't think that they're going to run away screaming or complain. I think they can go toe to toe with the EFF. And they've got heavy hitters on their side as well. So I think it's going to energize parliamentary debate. But as I say, it's the first day. The debate continues today. So maybe we'll see more of it today and be in a better position to judge.
So contrasting impressions are from the EFF being unruly, and then you've got the DA on the extreme opposite end being gentlemanly, but both of them did tear the president's speech to shreds. Was there any common ground shared by both the EFF and the DA when it came to their thoughts on the president's speech?
Yes, the common thread was the issue of economic transformation. You see, while the ANC keeps hyping this issue up and saying that it's now entering this phase of radical economic transformation, it doesn't translate into real issues. You can't read from the president's speech, for example, as to what this means in definitive terms. And obviously, both the EFF and the DA, that was the soft spot that they hit at, that you're not telling us what you mean. You need to put some real bones on this rhetoric. The other thing was the issue of youth unemployment. And both the DA and the EFF were saying that you haven't really announced anything that is able to deal with the crisis of youth unemployment. So they were common factors, but it's just the way they present their arguments, and the EFF is obviously much more aggressive in the way they do so.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Ranjeni. We'll let you go at this point in time. Hopefully the EFF keep up with these kinds of antics, because if Parliament can start to be this exciting, then I think a lot more South Africans will start paying even more attention to what happens.
Absolutely. And it certainly, revs up our ability to report on it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for your time, Ranjeni.
My pleasure, Mabale.
Okay. Sisonke, your thoughts on Julius Malema? I mean, I know that he entertained you as well.
He did entertain me. I think, the real issue is that in that short time that Julius had the stage, he did the exact opposite of what the president did the night before. So, my article this week was really about how boring Zuma was, and mm-hmm. how his use of figures and statistics is really a ploy to get us to not focus on the fact that the government is not delivering. So throw all of these facts at us and sort of make us believe that they're busy doing what they need to do, but in fact they're not. Whereas Malema actually took the stage in 5 minutes, he got more points scored than the president had in an hour. But I also think that the thing with Julius is, as with all human beings, his biggest strength is also his biggest weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he has the ability to really be impatient, to be disruptive, to talk about radical change is great, and that's why we're attracted to him. But you could see that the members of the House have already figured out a strategy for disrupting him, which is to test his patience with the rules. And I think that's really going to be the test for Julius Malema and the EFF. Can they sustain the energy while still observing the rules? Because what they did was they shortened something that should have been 10 minutes, and he only got 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they continued to interrupt him because he wasn't observing the rules. He's going to have to learn the rules if he's going to play the game well.
It almost paints him as this unruly child, if you will. He is younger than most of the members in Parliament. Is that something that could potentially work against him if he wants to be a commanding leader going forward? The fact that he's almost exposing himself by displaying immature tactics?
Exactly. So I think in a sense, again, it's the same issue of his biggest strengths are his biggest weaknesses.
Mm.
The reason he got into Parliament is because he appeals to youth.
Mm-hmm.
He's different in style. He's a dramatic personality. The reason why he may fail and stumble is precisely because of that. He is one of the youngest members of Parliament. He's also one of the smartest. They also behaved incredibly immaturely in how they addressed him.
Mm.
So what's happening is at the same time you've got this fantastic energy, you also have in some ways an attempt to dumb down Parliament because people are trying to deal with the Malema factor. So what the EFF has to do is to, in a sense, de-Malemarize their party. They have to bring the other voices in the EFF so that the EFF's content, its policies, its energy get the attention rather than Julius Malema.
Some people also say that because Julius Malema is so outrageous, that tends to outshine or shadow his intelligence, which a lot of people are surprised, you know, when they take the time to actually sit down and listen to the man, and when he's not making outrageous statements, people are surprised and they say, I didn't realize he was so intelligent.
Exactly. He's incredibly intelligent. He's very strategic, and he has to walk that fine line between playing by the rules of the house that he now occupies and being radical. And that's not an easy path to walk, but if he doesn't walk it properly, he will either end up getting himself kicked out every single time, which is not going to be productive or helpful for him or anyone else in parliament, or he'll really rise to the occasion and people will hear him and hear his party, more importantly, and the radical, quote unquote, to use a phrase the ANC has kind of tried to co-opt, the radical agenda that they want to bring into parliament.
0861-555-189. If you'd like to be a part of our conversation this afternoon, we'll be taking your calls throughout the hour. You can also send your messages to us on the WeChat Cliff Central official account. Now, Sisonke, I want to get into your article on the Daily Maverick, which you can find on dailymaverick.co.za. Your interpretation and your breakdown on what you thought about the President's State of the Nation address. And it starts with this. The real critique of SONA is not that it was boring. It is that the speech was boring on purpose, because it sought to depoliticize meaningful things and subsume them under the rubric of fast-tracked implementation, stakeholder engagement, and delivery mechanisms. Which means what exactly, Sisonke?
So I always make this joke that my six-year-old, when she's extremely bored by what I'm saying, she'll say, yeah, blah, blah, never mind, yeah, yeah. Right. And that was essentially what I found myself saying, muttering under my breath the entire time I was listening to President Zuma. But as I started to think about it a little bit more, I was saying to myself in February at the last SONA, at the closing of Parliament before, you know, before we went into the official election campaigning mode, the president delivered actually a very interesting speech. He was entertaining. He was high energy. Remember, he talked about a good story. Mm. I mean, people really complimented him. You could say what you want about the content, but he clearly rose to the occasion. So he knows how to not be boring, right?
Right.
So it seemed to me then that there's something else going on with this reading out of these numbers. And part of what the ANC has increasingly started to do is to list things in a very dry, technical language. Because if you bring down all of these protests, these fires burning, this anger, Marikana, all of the things that people are very angry about, if you actually talk about them in real ways, I think the ANC and the president in particular is scared of doing that. So what's the best way to distract our attention? List the facts. Make it so that people are actually having a different conversation than what people really want to talk about. People are totally uninterested in fast-tracked implementation. What does that even mean?
I don't know.
Exactly. So it was a speech full of phrases that normal people do not understand. Government speak, you know, the jargon that is so both boring but designed to make somebody seem sophisticated and that they actually know what they're talking about, which I'm sure he does, but actually that's not what people want to talk about. So the whole design of the speech, the terms he used, the numbers he was throwing at us, was designed to distract us from the real things that we want to talk about. It's classic. It's what you do with your child. Divert their attention, right? Change the subject.
Yeah.
And essentially, the whole SONA was a change of subject.
And why would that be a strategy that the speech writer, because, you know, obviously the president has a speech writer, why would that be a tactic or a strategy for them to use?
Because I think there's an increasing feeling that they're under attack. You know, this Marikana strike has been a very important and meaningful shift in the landscape of our country. And it's something that the ANC and the government in particular has not handled well. Gandla has been a huge kind of blight on the president's reputation. It made no reference to Gandla. How could he, right? And yet, if you look at the connection between what's been in the headlines in the last 6 months, for example, State of the Nation. State of the Nation should talk about what the nation is concerned about and talking about. If you look at the connection, there was none.
Well, I mean, what the nation is talking about is the fact that we've been downgraded a point economically. The state of the nation is not exactly encouraging at the moment.
Precisely. And so what better way to not talk about the fact that the state of the nation is not encouraging than to list a bunch of facts about all the things that the government has done. We've put in this many toilets, this bucket system, we've built this many schools. And that's great to list, but it's not enough for people. And so again, it's a case of distracting people by listing a whole bunch of boring things and hoping that they'll get lost in the detail. So you're looking at micro issues when everyone wants to talk about the big macro issues, the economy, the fact that there's no jobs being created, the fact that we live in a deeply unequal society, and the fact that corruption is rampant.
The general consensus among a lot of South Africans was that, yes, Mr. President, more of the same. He's basically trying to dupe us, but we cannot be duped anymore at this point. That puts him in a difficult position.
He's in a very difficult position. I mean, a lot of people have commented that he did seem tired. He seems strained. His voice was lower. He had much less energy than we've seen him having in the past. He had a few moments of bright spot, as Julius Malema pointed out. You know, the only part where he seemed to come alive was when he was talking about people must clean, you know, during the Mandela Day. And then, you know, that seemed to be something that made him laugh. But other than that, on the real hard issues, he didn't seem either to have a lot of energy or really to fully understand the depth of the problems that we're facing as a country.
I'm going to keep making reference to points that you wrote in your article on the Daily Maverick. And one of the things you say here is, I have learned to approach President Zuma's speeches with low expectations. Why is that?
Because if you have low expectations, then he surprises you when he does well. So in February, I was very happily surprised. But, you know, typically when the president has to make formal remarks, that's not his strength, right? He's much more interesting and engaging when he speaks off the cuff. Although I think an example of that where he was a bit too honest was immediately after the elections, where he said, you see, you people, you've been talking about Nkandla. Ha! It made no difference because look how we won. So I think the president doesn't do well in the formal speech space. And so I've learned to just lower my expectations and not expect that these big events are used to the maximum effect. I know that South Africa is not, a Western place. I know that we shouldn't expect the kind of things that we see in the State of the Union address that Barack Obama does. But in a way, when you have that platform, the advantage of being the president is that you have an hour of the nation's undivided attention. What a waste to give us statistics then, instead of really talking to us from the heart, even putting an agenda that maybe comes from left field that we didn't expect.
But Sisonke, is it possible for the leader of the state, of any state at that, it doesn't just have to be South Africa, is it possible for politicians to speak to us honestly? Because this is what I'm sensing from you. You wanted him to be honest with us in that speech.
Yeah, I think
it is. Is he even capable of that?
I don't know if he personally is. I doubt it. But I think you raise a very good question. Politics, by definition, is deceitful.
It's strategic. It's like a chess game.
Yeah, so you don't necessarily speak from the heart. At the same time, you are able to put out messages that kind of shape the agenda of what people are interested in and what people care about. So even if he's not going to speak from the heart, I think it would be important for the president of any country to use the platform to speak about questions that the nation is talking about. So that would be more of my expectation.
You made reference to Barack Obama, and one of his strong points is that he's a good orator, which is something that, when it comes to President Jacob Zuma, a lot of people make fun of the delivery of his speech, but when people criticize the State of the Nation address, are they criticizing the delivery? Are they criticizing the content of the speech? Are they criticizing both? Are they criticizing one more than the other?
I think people tend to criticize his delivery, and I think they tend to do that too much. And for me, obviously there's always a relationship between your content and your delivery, right? So I'm less concerned about his delivery and more concerned about what it is that he has to say. And if he had something meaningful to say, then he wouldn't have to throw statistics at us. So, for example, if the president decided, you know what, all this stuff is too hot. I can't deal with having to engage on Gandla. I don't want to talk about the Marikana strike. What if he decided to take something that all South Africans can probably agree on?
Like what?
If he decided to say gender-based violence is a massive problem in our country. It's something that has affected me personally in my life. I made an unintended disclosure about my wife being attacked in, you know, our village home. Mm. And it's something that bothers me every single day. And I want us as a nation to really get behind what we're going to do to solve this problem. I am deploying 500 police who will blah, blah, blah. And then he can list us a few things that are practical that he's going to do about it, but spend the bulk of that time really honing in on something that's going to unite South Africans and that he knows people care about.
Another thing that you mentioned in your article, you say the ruling party increasingly relies on a technocratic approach to fend off overly political questions. Is this what you mean when you mention the political phrases that they throw at us and really they're just hiding behind a bigger problem?
Exactly. So if you'll notice, one of the things that the president had, he had some funny sentence there that I will take over the mining agreement of 2012 and that the social compact, blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. So hiding underneath somewhere there when you hear the word mining, what you're really hearing is platinum belt strike. What you're really hearing is people are angry about Marikana. So I'm not going to address it head on. I'm going to come from the side and I'll make it sound as though we've got some fantastic policy solution when actually the solution around the strike was dialogue, was a political intervention, which the government began and then they withdrew from it because for whatever reason, we don't have that kind of political leadership. So what we have is a technocratic, technical kind of leadership. So let's fix the pipes. Let's figure out how to turn the taps on. But let's not deal with the community anger when those things don't work.
But there are issues that normal South Africans are dealing with that do require those exact solutions that you referred to. Sometimes the pipe does need to be fixed and you do need to put in more taps where there aren't any.
Exactly. And in our country, what tends to happen is that because we only are focusing on the technocratic and yet at the same time not always hiring the right people to run those technocratic processes, because of backhanded political deals, right? So you put the wrong person in the job to fix the taps. When the taps don't work, there's no political solution because it requires a political solution as well as a technical solution, right? Mm. You need someone to turn the taps back on. You also need someone to explain to the community why it happened in the first place. We all know, right? When someone does something wrong or makes a mistake, you both want the mistake to be fixed, but you want an apology and an explanation about why it's not going to happen again. So instead, we've got the fixing of the taps sometimes, but no conversation. And the role of a state and the role of political leaders is to have difficult, unruly conversations and make us feel like things are going to be okay.
What is the biggest issue South Africa is facing right now, which you feel the president did not address in his address?
I think he didn't address any of the big issues. So he talked about putting the economy center stage. As Ranjani just pointed out to us, we were hearing more of the same. Mm-hmm. There was no real plan for how we're going to get this economy back on track. There was no real mention about the platinum belt strike. There was no explanation as to why the Minister of Mines involved himself and then removed himself from the process. So that wasn't addressed. What else do people care about? There was no real addressing of crime. So in many ways, what was the most important thing people got out of it? The little laughter about the Joburg building crisis. But Joburg is not South Africa, right? There was some discussion about the importance of local government and the fact that we do have some municipalities that are failing. So that was good. Naming some of the names of the municipalities that are not doing well, I think, was a very good point that he made. But again, did it in very technical language rather than saying, guys, we know there are problems and here's how we're going to fix them.
I want to move on to the deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, now. And again, I refer to dailymaverick.co.za. And Rebecca Davies has written an article about Cyril Ramaphosa. And here's just a snippet of what she writes. She says, with Jacob Zuma out of action due to ill health, it has been Cyril Ramaphosa who has been filling his shoes at official functions and looking as if those shoes were fitting him pretty nicely. Deputy presidents are often relegated to the status of mere figureheads, as Khalema Motlanthe discovered, but there are already indications that Ramaphosa will not be lying down. Rebecca, good afternoon. I'm going to bring you into this conversation now. There's a lot of talk surrounding Cyril Ramaphosa these days. We have been seeing a lot more of him, so I suppose it's not surprising that he's kind of the man of the moment.
He is the man of the moment, I think. And obviously there's a good practical reason for why he would be coming to the fore now, and that is, of course, President Jacob Zuma's reported ill health, although we're still not sure of the exact extent of that. But these are the situations in which the job of the deputy president is, of course, precisely to step up and fill the role. But nonetheless, it was really noticeable, particularly at a post-Senate breakfast briefing in Cape Town yesterday, just how presidential Cyril Ramaphosa was looking. And really, it's a time when, you know, we're seeing President Zuma take his new term of office at a time when his administration has been drenched in scandal, when there seems to be very little excitement about his term. And Ramaphosa, I think, will increasingly be stepping into the spotlight a little more in order to perhaps, counter some of that. But also, this is a moment when I think Ramaphosa can be seen to come to the fore, because there is a sort of a vacuum, particularly if Zuma is to be less and less available for public engagement if his ill health continues.
You know, we've seen Cyril at a lot of prominent events since the president had to take that week of absence. He delivered the eulogy at Mambeki's funeral. He gave the youth address in Kimberley on Youth Day. He chaired the ANC's Lekgotla. But I just want to ask here, in comparing the two, Jacob Zuma, at the moment, he's frail, he's ill. People are not happy with his State of the Nation address. Cyril Ramaphosa, fit, strong, healthy. We're kind of seeing him, filling in where the president has not. So really, it's not all that surprising that this comparison between the two has come up, and the deputy president almost seems to be overshadowing the president.
Yeah, I think you're right that there's also an inevitable aesthetic comparison there at the moment, because Zuma was not looking at his finest on Tuesday night at the State of the Nation. And Ramaphosa is more than 10 years younger than him. He's clearly fit, strong, and healthy. He looked extremely relaxed at the breakfast briefing yesterday. He was using his role to sort of fill in the bits of the speech that caused a lot of anger from opposition politicians. For instance, the fact that Jacob Zuma inexplicably failed to make mention of what is a huge worry for many people, that South Africa's credit rating has been downgraded, which we saw no mention of in Zuma's address. So Ramaphosa was on hand to take that up. And I think it's that, you know, Ramaphosa is not himself an uncontroversial figure at the moment, particularly as the Farlam Commission continues. We know of his role as a director of Lonmin, and we're still not even entirely sure just how culpable Ramaphosa himself was in the incidents leading up to the Marikana massacre. But it's not the case that Ramaphosa will be a universally loved figure should he actually ascend to the presidency. But he is also a figure who probably inspires a lot more confidence from business than Jacob Zuma. Probably international investors would feel more confident with Ramaphosa at the helm, given that he is a man who has substantial experience in the corporate world himself. So it would depend what sector you're in that you would appraise Ramaphosa from. If you are a mine worker, for instance, the lefty NGOs certainly would be much less positive about the prospect of a Ramaphosa presidency. But there's little doubt that he could possibly instill particularly a higher degree of investor confidence, I think, in South Africa than Zuma has managed to hitherto.
Rebecca, you also mentioned in your article Ramaphosa is a less trained public speaker than his boss. He spoke largely without reference to his notes. Asked outright by Peter Ndoro if he was being groomed to be president, he countered with a quip that he was indeed preparing to be president of his golf club. But is Cyril Ramaphosa being groomed to be the next president?
Look, he obviously has the support of a number of senior ANC figures. We saw this a couple of years ago, in fact, when the current tourism minister, Derek Hanekom, said that he hoped, for the sake of the country, that Ramaphosa would consider stepping back on some of his business interests and taking up a position. And on that occasion, Ramaphosa again laughed it off as a joke. So that seems to be his modus operandi when it comes to these suggestions, to laugh it off. I thought it was interesting in that regard that he said he was being groomed to be president of his golf club. It was obviously a casual joke, but, you know, it's an interesting choice of joke because it indicates the milieu from which Ramaphosa speaks, you know, that he is a member of a golf club. You know, this is a billionaire that we're talking about, and I thought it was also significant during the speech that while extolling the virtues of the ANC's National Development Plan, he kept exhorting South Africans to download the NDP on their tablets, which again, I mean, admittedly, he was addressing a very particular crowd, which is well-heeled politicians and businessmen at a business briefing. But again, suggests a man who has come a significant distance from his unionist roots. I mean, no longer perhaps a man of the people so much as a man very much situated within wealth and privilege. So it will also be interesting to see whether he would be able to overcome that in the public perception of the majority of this country who are not that well-heeled crowd that he was addressing yesterday.
What do you think are some of the biggest differences between somebody like Cyril Ramaphosa and then Kgalema Motlanthe, who essentially, you know, when he left, he really was reduced to just a figurehead, as you mentioned in the article, as opposed to Cyril Ramaphosa, who at this point in time is looking more like the president of this nation. What is the difference between these two men?
You know, I think that Ramaphosa has been a more visible part of this country's political fabric for a lot longer. He obviously, as head of the National Union of Mine Workers in the 80s, played a very significant role in our country's political history in terms of really mobilizing the labor struggle at that time. And, you know, if you watch Rehad Desai's documentary, Mining Shut Down, there's some really interesting footage of Ramaphosa revealing just how central he's been to the ANC in the pre- and post-democratic era. For instance, you see Nelson Mandela in that documentary addressing the crowds in Cape Town's City Hall directly after his release from Victor Verster prison, and it's Ramaphosa who is next to him holding the microphone. And of course, we have reason to believe that Ramaphosa thought his moment as president would come a lot earlier. It didn't. And perhaps this is his time to take over. But in answer to your question, so I think that we're just a lot more familiar with Ramaphosa as a figure. He's sort of always been part of our democratic life. He's had, even as a businessman, he's been in the public spotlight a lot more than Kgalema Motlanthe. So in terms of brand recognition alone, I think he probably has a lot more to offer than someone like Motlanthe, who, you know, I think in terms of his personality as well, a lot lower profile, a very modest, humble man, sort of staying out of the fracas of politics, laying low quite a bit. And I don't think that is what we've come to expect from Ramaphosa.
It's one thing to have the support, which it seems Cyril Ramaphosa does have, to be the next president. But it's another thing to ask whether he would be the right man for the job. You know, is he a better businessman than he is a leader? Like, is he the right man to take over next?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And, you know, even with regards to his business history, although he's obviously been personally successful, he has presided over a number of failed deals, including the huge and much valorized New African Independent Investments Limited and the NAIL initiative, which he sort of, well, under his stewardship, came to nothing, went bust. So, you know, we don't have a whole lot of evidence of exactly what kind of a manager even Ramaphosa would be. The question, as I said, is whether he could really mobilize public support. There is a lot of anger about his involvement in the London strike. And even before that, before he had made his decision to enter active politics again, he was making news for reasons which perhaps are not ideal for a future president, such as his much-publicized bidding on a buffalo for, you know, tens of millions of rands. Is that the kind of message we want to be seeing from a president, that they have millions to spend on buffaloes at auctions at a time when unemployment and poverty is rife in South Africa? It seems that that would be, at best, you know, a controversial kind of messaging, especially when the ANC is paying a lot of lip service these days to the need to see the fruits of the democratic era economically spread more widely. They speak of radical economic transformation. That's clearly one of the buzzwords of the new parliament. And yet Ramaphosa himself, of course, is the, you know, the absolute embodiment of the new elite, having completely turned his back on his working class unionist roots and having, you know, just adopted the lifestyle of the wealthy and privileged completely.
All right, Rebecca, thank you very much for your time. That's where we'll leave it this afternoon. Rebecca's article, and all the articles, in fact, from the journalists on the Daily Maverick, you can find on dailymaverick.co.za. Now, Sisonke, let's move on to the Phenzi Tlakola story. First of all, as a way of just getting on track with what is happening, the Electoral Court's recommendation on Wednesday that IEC Chair Phanzile Kula be removed from her position, that was a finding, and that also it was welcomed by three of the parties who had brought the application, those parties being, or some of those parties being the UDM, the EFF, Akgang SA, Christian Democratic Party, and the Congress of the People. No doubt members of these parties will be thrilled with this ruling.
I think they will, and as the Electoral Court has shown, I think in some ways they're vindicated. This is a for me, I think this is a particularly sad one, and I think if you read Stephen Hutter's article on the Daily Maverick today, you'll also sense that deep sense of disappointment from him. I remember listening to him interviewing her when the scandal first broke, and he was sort of incredulous because she was so belligerent and refusing to accept that she might have done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Electoral Court finding is one of only three, which shows everyone is agreeing. There was, a KPMG report that was done. Then there was the Public Protector's findings. And now there's the Electoral Court. All three have agreed that essentially she misrepresented the facts. She avoided a tender and took a shortcut.
Yet she's still saying she did nothing wrong. Is this just a defensive mechanism at this point? When the overwhelming majority are pointing the finger at you.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it's not unusual in our politics for people in senior prominent positions to deny, even on the face of overwhelming evidence that they've done something wrong. It's especially disappointing because she's someone who's been part of the post-apartheid democratic landscape for as long as we can remember. She has steered us through all five national elections, first in the position of CEO of the IEC, and now in the last electoral period as the chairperson, a very hands-on chairperson of those elections. So she's technically very sound. She's excellent at her job. She's been someone who stood for very strongly and firmly for democratic principles, for the rule of law. I personally have worked with her in a number of arenas outside of South Africa, and she's always stood for democratic principles outside South Africa and conditions that are hard. But she's done the wrong thing, and it's time for her to bow down.
Let's just go through some of these things that people are saying that she's done wrong. They believed that Tlakula had behaved improperly over the leasing of the Electoral Commission of South Africa's headquarters in Centurion back in 2009. Thuli Madonsela found, among other things, that Tlakula had a relationship, possibly of a romantic nature, with then Chair of Parliament's Finance Portfolio Committee, Thabo Mofumahadi. Questions of morality being raised here?
No, I think in a sense they're one and the same. So the original sin is that she was in a business relationship with whom she's also believed to be in a romantic relationship. So it's Mfamadi.
Yeah.
And so and he was actively involved in politics and so on. But the original sin is not the relationship. I think that's not there's no question of her morality in that sense. The question of her morality is to provide a tender for the new office space that the IEC was going to move into, and to do that in a company in which she was a co-owner with him, and to not recuse herself from the process and to avoid the whole full tendering process. So she took shortcuts, and she presided over a process in which, even if she was not to stand personally financially, although it's hard to see how she wasn't going to be since she was a co-owner in the business, it seems very fishy to do that. And that, I think what the court found was that even if there was going to be no benefit to her, the appearance of the conflict was so fundamental that she should have acted differently given the position that she sits in.
Bantu Holomisa of the UDM was quoted saying that this decision is long overdue and that she's been a waste of everyone's time. This has been dragging out for too long. Would you agree that it's taken quite a long process to get to this point?
I think it's a waste of public resources. I think it's a waste of the money of the IEC to be defending its chairperson on something where she's clearly wrong. And so I agree with him. She's been wasting time. I think the process has been now close to a year. I could be wrong in that. But whatever amount of time it's taken for us to get to the stage, given that the evidence seems to be pretty compelling that she made a very bad series of decisions, he's absolutely right. And he's also said that he hopes that if she decides to appeal this, which I think for the sake of the nation she should not, but should she decide to appeal, he said that the parties will try to make sure that she doesn't use the IEC's money for that appeal.
Another question that was raised is, why did it have to get to the point of for it to get to the courts? Because, you know, some people were saying this was an obvious decision that should have been made a long time ago. But, you know, there's processes you need to go through.
And if the person wants to push it to that stage, then it's their legal right to do so. I think we'd be having a different conversation about using the processes had the court vindicated her. I mean, I think it speaks to a larger issue in our society, which is about the accountability of public officials, not just politicians, but people who hold senior positions in government, who are respected, who the public trusts, who are entrusted with a lot of power and a lot of access to financial decisions. And the fact that too often they're caught making bad decisions, and that even where they are found to be guilty, in this case, there still remains the issue of whether or not she will resign. And the only body that can remove her is Parliament. And we know that Parliament is 62% African National Congress. So I think there are real questions about whether this really is the end of the road for her.
Interesting that you say that, because the Electoral Commission of South Africa did say that they noted the ruling, but they need time to study it, which means what exactly?
They need time to study it, but they actually can't act. So when the biggest boss in your institution has gone wrong, what do? Right? So staff can't take action against their chairperson. The CEO cannot take action against his chairperson. Parliament is her boss, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so Parliament has to make a decision about what to do with her if she decides that she's going to take it all the way and not resign. So I think there's a sort of feeling amongst people in the general public that perhaps she should step down now. But if she chooses not to, then we can still see this playing itself out for a while longer until Parliament makes a decision.
Now, you've mentioned that you felt personally let down by this whole situation because she was somebody that you admired and respected. And, you know, you associated her with somebody who was a believer of good ethics and all of that. What do you make of the way that she's handled this whole situation? Because I remember there was a time when she was labeled as arrogant. There was a time when she flat out refused to cooperate with forensic auditors. And people were saying, you know, even the way that she's handling the situation is a clear indication that she is guilty and she knows that she's done something wrong.
I think, it's one of those cases where the belief in herself was so firm that she either knew she had done nothing wrong or was acting with absolute impunity. I think we'll all recall the quite serious clash that took place between herself and the public protector. And in a sense, to shift the conversation slightly, what I think this ruling does do is it further bolsters the independence and the integrity of the public protector, which I think, again, at a time when so many people are letting us down in our country in terms of democratic institutions and voices, is particularly important that the public protector has also been vindicated in this regard. Mm. She still has lots of fights to take up. There are cases that come to that office on a daily basis. There's still a long road to be for her to walk in terms of challenges to Nkandla. So I think in some ways, if there is any good that's come out of this process with the IEC, it's the fact that it's been a reaffirming of how solid and spot on the leadership and the findings of the public protector have been pretty consistently in the last few years.
Of the parties that brought this application, the UDM, EFF, AGANG, Christian Democratic Party, it's interesting to note that the ANC and the DA did not join that application. What should we read into that, if anything at all?
I think part of it was around the timing of the application. So you'll recall that they were seeking to remove her before the elections took place. And it was literally, I think, a week. It was a few days until elections when they approached the electoral court. And I think the larger parties didn't feel that whatever wrongs she may or may not have done, that warranted such a disruptive effect on the process of elections. And I think in some ways that was a mature decision. I don't think presiding over a scam on a potential scam on a lease of an office is the same thing as questioning the ability of a whole nation and a whole IEC to run a proper and effective election.
Now, you mentioned that you feel this is not necessarily the end for her. So what happens next? This gets handed over to Parliament. This goes through another process. What happens at this point?
If Tlakula refuses to step down, then yes, this will need to get handed over to Parliament, and a decision and recommendation then will be made.
All right. Thank you very much, Sisonke Msimang, for joining me this afternoon on News Talk. with the Daily Maverick. We'll be back next week, Tuesday at 1 o'clock, right here on cliffcentral.com.